So, good evening, folks. It's good to see you all again. Tonight I plan to just continue on with this series of talks I've been giving on the Four Noble Truths. So tonight is the third talk, so I talk about the third noble truth. I want to start actually with a quote. This is from the first discourse the Buddha ever gave to the five monks in the forest that he used to sit with. He says, "Now this, bhikkhus, is the noble truth of the cessation of dukkha, the remainderless fading and renunciation, release and letting go of craving." That's the third noble, that's what the third noble truth is. I mean, and you can actually, make this talk like two sentences long, okay, which I'm not going to do, but I mean, it's like, it's really simple. What does it mean to end suffering is what he uses here. And that's the, basically, it's the stop craving, he says casually, right? All we have to do is stop craving and clinging. It's like, but that's what it means. It's like, remember the first noble truth was, we're all caught in this world of unsatisfactoriness. And second noble truth had to do with, well, things are unsatisfactory because we cling. So the third noble truth is quite simple. It says, well, just stop clinging. But what does it mean to stop clinging, to end suffering, to have that remainderless fading? It basically, the Buddha described himself the first one of the first times someone asked him, "Who is he? Who are you?" He said, "I'm the one who no longer suffers." That's how he answered that question. "Who are you?" He said, "I am the one who no longer suffers." So end of suffering means enlightenment. That's what it means. I mean, complete, remainderless release and letting go of craving. That's the definition of enlightenment. So the real question is, well, what does that mean? What does it mean to be enlightened? First of all, I have to tell you that I don't know completely, because I can only tell you what I've learned from studying and from small, brief moments that seem to be something like enlightenment in my practice time. But it's not, this is the most difficult question. And the problem with it is it's pretty much unanswerable in words. Because if when we w one of the things we had to stop clinging to is a sense of a separate self. So as long as we're if we're really not clinging to a sense of separate self, then we've sort of stepped outside the world of duality, of me, not me. But there's no, I mean, I can say those words, but they don't really explain it. They don't. Because words are meant to function in the world of duality. I mean, speaking means there's me, excuse me speaking and you listening. That's just the nature of speech. It implies more than one. So we're using an imperfect method to describe something that's indescribable anyway. And it said, and read this, seen this in several different places. It says, the only person who can really know if someone's enlightened is someone else who's enlightened. That's the criteria. If I'm enlightened and I see another being who's enlightened, I'd recognize it. Otherwise, I'm just, making my best guesses. So you see the problem here. It's like we're trying to define the undefinable, describe the undescribable. And I've got, so what I'm going to do, and how it's often taught in all kinds of different traditions, is when you can't explain what it is, well, let's just see if we can explain what it isn't. And if we can, with our explanation of what it isn't, if we're really good, we'll eliminate everything except what it is. Not, doesn't sound too, this is like get into the intensely philosophical world quite quickly here. But I'll talk more about that later. But sometimes it's useful to just to have like a little story that sort of describes the problem. This is a classic teaching story. This is from this book I love called What the Buddha Taught by Walpola Rahula, which is basically in this thin little volume, condensed down all of the wisdom of the Buddha in this short little book. But it's quite good. It's like has it gets pretty dense sometimes, but it's interesting to look at. So truth is not such a category. Therefore, there cannot be words to express that experience. Just as a fish has no words in his vocabulary to express the nature of the solid land. The tortoise told his friend the fish that he, the tortoise, just returned to the lake after a walk on the land. Of course, the fish said, you mean swimming. The tortoise tried to explain that one couldn't swim on the land, that it was solid, and that one walked on it. But the fish insisted that there could be nothing like it, that it must be liquid like his lake with waves, and that one must be able to dive and swim there. This is, the classic story of you're trying to explain something to someone who doesn't have the context. If I'm not enlightened, I don't have the context to explain and understand enlightenment. It's a problem, but doesn't mean I'm going to stop trying to explain it. So often it's also stated, I mean, here's other ways it's stated, and as I said, often it's stated by the negative. Here's what it's not. So it's the end of greed, hatred, and delusion. In other words, we're no longer caught by the three poisons. In classic Indian traditions, philosophical traditions, there's a practice called neti neti. Neti neti means not this, not this. And in this is in the Hindu tradition of jnana yoga, where they actually try and say everything that enlightenment's not. If I can just, like I said, if I just keep thinking about what it's not, and then anything that's left over has to be what it is. And there's a whole philosophical tradition built around trying to figure this out. Not something I think is a great idea, but this is. It's like there's a, like I said, this is a very traditional philosophical system in India, and particularly in certain yoga communities and worlds. Then we have words that are often used to describe this: the unborn, the ungrown, the unknown, the unconditioned. But they all sound sort of negative. But negative and positive are relative terms. Enlightenment, nibbana, is about absolute reality. So it's beyond relative terms. Relative terms imply there's a this and a that. Something to compare something else with. But there's nothing to compare this with because it just is. It's not because it's in the world of absolute reality, it has no duality like explanation. This is just approaches people have taken to try and explain this, right? Here's another one. Nibbana isn't the result of practice, because being a result implies a cause and condition, which means something happened to make this happen. And another thing that's often said about enlightenment is there is no direct cause. It just happens. So saying that it's the result of practice is implies a dualistic system. And that can't be the case with this thing that's in absolute reality and beyond the duality. Told you this wasn't going to be easy. Okay, wait. So how about some sutta though? Maybe we can see this in the sutta. This is from the Samyutta Nikaya. And this is sort of a classic teaching of the Buddha. And in many places in the sutta, some Brahmin comes to question the Buddha or question one of the Buddha's senior disciples in the trying to get into the process of debate with this person. In all of the Indian traditions at this time in India, basically, if two people from opposite or different traditions debated and one of them clearly won, the person who lost was required to become the student of the person who won. Give up their stuff and go with this other thing instead. That was how things worked. It was highly competitive debate. But that's how part of how the tradition in the philosophical world of North India in that time, that's how it operated. Anyhow, so this Brahmin has come and he's talking to Mahakasapa, who's one of the Buddha's main disciples. And how is it, friend Kasapa? Does the Tathagata exist after death? The Blessed One, friend, has not declared this, the Tathagata exists after death. Then, friend, does the Tathagata not exist after death? The Blessed One, friend, has not declared this either. The Tathagata does not exist after death. How is it then, friend? Does the Tathagata both exist and not exist after death? Blessed One, friend, has not declared this. The Tathagata both exists and does not exist after death. Then, friend, does the Tathagata neither exist nor not exist after death? Covering all the bases, right? The Blessed One, friend, has not declared this either. At this point, of course, the Brahmin is getting pretty frustrated because he's given the all four of what could be the correct answer to the question, does the Buddha exist after death? He either exists or doesn't exist, he both exists and doesn't exist, or neither of those are true. This is classic philosophical discourse. And so the Brahmin says, why hasn't the Blessed One declared this, friend? And here's the classic answer. Because this is unbeneficial, irrelevant to the fundamentals of the holy life, and does not lead to revulsion, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nibbana. Therefore, the Blessed One has not declared this. So basically, what Kassapa is saying is the Buddha hasn't ever answered this question because it's a ridiculous question. It's not a question that's worth trying to answer. So then the question becomes, well, why is that? Why is this not a useful question? And it comes down to this. If you look at the four different things that he came through, that the Buddha exists after death, that the Buddha doesn't exist after death, etc., they all imply a separate existence. That the Buddha is going to exist and then not exist implies that at some point there's something called the Buddha that exists separate from everything else that then disappears. And that just creates this sense of a separate self. That this guy they're calling the Tathagata has a separate self. So it's not worth asking that question even because that in itself isn't true. This is philosophy. I'm sorry. I could, but it's fascinating. It's like all the ways they try to sort of deal with this and say this and get there somehow or other. Because there's no self that's going to die. That's what this whole thing is implying. There's no self, so how can the self die? Okay. So another thing they do, I'm going through my list of fascinatingly weird things I've discovered about how people try and talk about this. They use sort of sometimes rather complicated metaphors, or what to me seem like complicated metaphors. So think of a house that's oriented so that its ends are east and west, right? The sun rises in the east and shines through the window, hits the west wall. So, and that means we know what happened to the light because the light is shining on the wall. But the metaphor says, what if there is no west wall? Where does the light land then? Does it just keep going? Well, I don't know. It's like when you think about it, there's no answer. There's no answer to the question. Because, light just seems to go on forever, right? I mean, it's not like we're. Okay. So this like nibbana can't be explained where the light lands if there's no wall for it to land on, based on this metaphor. It can't be explained either. It's how metaphors work, right? Then it's interesting in the Metta Sutta, which basically lays out the Buddha's teachings on metta, the practice of metta, loving kindness. The very last line, which is basically saying that if you practice this to in the way the Buddha describes, you become an enlightened being. The very last line is not born again into this world. Oh, what does that mean? This is another classic Indian Eastern philosophical question. And now we get very quickly into the discussion of karma and reincarnation. I'm going to give a whole talk on this later in this series, but basically what's going on here is, and this is my teacher Guy's explanation, when we're born, when we get this particular body, this particular physical body, we are connected to part of, immersed in, pick your favorite word, a bundle of karmic energy that's part of this unending flow of things that are rising and falling. And we in our lives, if we're whether we're living wholesome lives or unwholesome lives, essentially affect that bundle of karmic energy. And if we're leading a life, a wholesome life of practice and discipline and virtue, we're hopefully we are enhancing that bundle of karmic energy so that at some point, some being who's born will have that bundle of karmic energy and benefit from what we're doing today in our simple practice and become an enlightened being. And at that point, that being, that bundle of karmic energy has served its purpose. And it's gone. It's not born again into this world. That's what this means. It means that just like everything else, things arise, they're there for a while, and then they're gone. So these bundles of karmic energy arise and they're there for a while. Well, it's a long while because they go through, depending on what stories you read and scriptures you read, thousands of lives have they. This bundle keeps incarnating, connected to yet another being. So it's not like I reincarnate. Just this energy keeps coming around, and a new being gets attached to it, and it enhances it a little bit more, and then so on until it's served this purpose, which is to create an enlightened being in the world. Then it's gone, like everything else. Then it's not born again into this world. It's an explanation of reincarnation and that I've always been comfortable with. Because I was never comfortable with the idea that I'm coming back. Doesn't seem likely somehow or other. Seems too it's too much sort of embedded in the idea of a separate self that has continuity, which is counter to all of the Buddhist teachings. It's like me wanting to keep going. Please, I want to keep going. Maybe in a new life, but it's still me. Sorry, that's me, whoever me is, gone at the end of this life. This physical body, mind, occurrence in the world. Okay. So these are ways you see this whole subject of what it means to be enlightened discussed in a variety of different suttas and different philosophical treatises and different ways of looking at things, right? But what does this mean to our practice? Here we are just practicing day to day. Uninstructed worldlings that we are, we're just sort of moving slowly towards enlightenment, we think, we hope. How can I think about this in terms of the practice itself? And unfortunately, Joseph Goldstein in his book Mindfulness speaks about this in one certain way, anyhow. And this is like in a section he has here that he's calling Ways to Abandon Craving. That's what we want to do. We want to, if we can abandon craving, then we're enlightened, right? So how do we go about doing that? And this what he has to say here, he says, you focus on the drawbacks of conditioned experience. Focus on the drawbacks of life in this world. You might have noticed there's a few drawbacks to life in this world, right? But this is what he has to say. Regarding the end of craving, the Buddha made a very obvious but often overlooked observation. When we focus on the gratification that comes from sense pleasures, desires increase. When we focus on the drawbacks of sense pleasures, craving diminishes. But how often in the midst of our involvement with the world of sense objects do we pay attention to whether we are further conditioning or deconditioning craving? So often do we think, oh, every time I give in to that craving, I'm conditioning myself to crave some more. Not something we want to think about, probably, right? This would be an interesting practice to bring to the world and see what we could learn from it. We can decondition, relinquish, and abandon craving through an increasingly refined awareness of the three characteristics. The more clearly we see the impermanence of all experience, the more we understand for ourselves the basic unreliability and ultimately unsatisfactory nature of all phenomena. And through a sustained, wise attention, we understand more deeply the selfless, impersonal nature of this whole unfolding process, that nothing lasts long enough to be considered self. These universal characteristics are the drawbacks, the dangers, the downsides of conditioned experience. So he's saying, I mean, on one level, when I first read this, it was like, ooh, sounded sort of like morbid almost. But what he's saying is, pay attention to what's actually happening around you all the time. Because what's actually happened to you all the time, if you really start to look, if you're really mindful, is you keep noticing that things arise, they're there for a while, and they're gone. We start to see that these philosophical ideas, and we might want to call them that, are actually what's happening. That everything is changing all the time, and so nothing is reliable as a source of happiness, because it's not going to last. Nothing ever is going to last. And I'm not saying, oh, we shouldn't enjoy things as we experience them. We shouldn't sort of, okay, become really grim. Okay, no, that's pleasant. I'm never going to do that again. That doesn't work either. But it's like being aware in the midst of that pleasurable experience, oh, this is just a passing phenomena like all other things. Can we sort of enjoy it and also be aware of it at the same time somehow? Finding that balance so that we're not conditioning ourselves to seek that pleasure again and again. If it comes along, enjoy it, absolutely. But don't catch yourself in just lost in wanting it again and again and again. And this is obviously a very fine balance. And eventually we can start to see, if we start to really look, that this sense of this separate self is just a story we tell ourselves. Can we actually become aware of that, as opposed to once again it being this interesting philosophical discussion we have with ourselves and with our friends or whatever about whether or not myself really exists? But that's what happens in practice. That's what part of why we practice is we start to see that it's the nature of where this practice takes us, to seeing these things more clearly. And it might be initially just this little moment of like, oh, no one home. Right now, I don't experience anyone being home at all. And then that becomes more frequent and more clear and more obvious. And then over time, we get to that place where, quote, we're enlightened, whatever that means. Anyhow. And the simplest way to do this is practicing mindfulness. It leads to notice how impermanence pervades our lives. And on one of my retreats a few years back, this teacher says something that it's like, well, you know, we talk about things arising and passing away. And it's like, that's how you see impermanence. But that's a big ask. So what he suggested is maybe you can start just by noticing when things arise. Oh, there's another one. Oh, there's another one. Just that. Just focus on the simpler part, which is seeing things arise. Because you'll notice as you start to pay real attention, that's all that's ever happening. More things keep arising and more things and more things. Just there's another one and another one and another one. That's all that's ever going on is things keep arising. And it's a way to see impermanence in a sense that it's like this, you start to see this constant flow of things arising. And then it sort of dawns on you, wait, if all those things are arising, what's happening to them? Well, they're all going away. I mean, they're not all just hanging around permanently. They're arising, and then we see by just noticing the arising, the constant flow of arisings, we start to get that picture that, yeah, things are arising all the time. They got to be going away as well. Okay. Then there's another question. This is another classic question that do with enlightenment. And the question is enlightenment gradual or is it instantaneous? Does it like happen over a long period of time? Or is it just like, poof, now you're enlightened? The interesting thing is the answer is yes. Depends on the angle you look at it from. Okay, for instance, this is from Anna Lyell's book, Satipatthana. And he's, once again, you know, back to metaphors and images as a way to explain this. And the image here is a chicken sitting on a bunch of eggs. Well, I mean, so that you know, if you don't take those eggs away like we do, chicken eggs hatch into little chickens, right? That's the way things work. And here's what Analeo has saying. The chick's sudden emergence from their shells depends on a gradual process of inner development through the hen incubating the eggs. Similarly, the sudden breakthrough to nibbana depends on a gradual process of inner development and mental cultivation. Just as the hen cannot directly cause the chicks to break their shells, the breakthrough to nibbana cannot be directly made to happen. It's a great image in that sense. It's like, you think about a chicken, you know, chicken sitting on the eggs can't just sort of peck at the eggs and then the little birds will come out. That'll just kill things, basically. It actually has to wait until the little bird breaks out itself. And that's what we have to do with enlightenment. We just have to keep creating the causes and conditions. We have to keep incubating our enlightenment egg until one day it hatches. Both will occur in their own time if the necessary conditions are in place. So this is like, I think this is a good image for what we're struggling with here, because, you know, we're all incubating our egg. That's what we're doing. We're all working on creating the causes and conditions that egg will develop to the point where one day it'll break out of its shell. Yes, and at that moment when it breaks out of the shell, it'll seem totally instantaneous. But it's only happening because we spend all our time incubating. Gradual, instantaneous. Depends when you look. Depends on how you think about it. It isn't, it's, there's no simple answer to that question because it's not one way or the other. It's either or both, somehow or other. Once again, here we are in the woods of philosophy, of course. And here's the interesting thing. I think this happens. It isn't like there's just a moment where all of a sudden the flip switches and you go from unenlightened to enlightened. I think, and I've read this and I've spoken to various teachers about this, that we all have little tiny moments of enlightenment in our practice. Just think about that moment where you're sitting and you're lost in thought, and then you remember. At that moment, it's like you wake up. It's an awakening. And we don't even recognize it as that because we're so caught up in, oh my God, I was spacing out again and beating ourselves up typically. But it's just like those are moments, little tiny mini moments of enlightenment. And all we're trying to do is sort of make them longer. And eventually we have times, moments, longer moments, bands of time where things are very different from our normal day-to-day perception of how things are. I'll tell you one personal experience. I was on a longer retreat at the Insight Meditation Society. So this is like week six. So I'm pretty concentrated at this point. And I've been doing sitting on my own and doing very long sitting practices. So it's about 5 o'clock at night. And this is in late October in Massachusetts. So it's not dark, but it's like dusk. And I decide, okay, enough sitting. I just sat for a couple hours. Time for me to get some exercise. And IMS has these incredible forests right there. You can walk in with trails. And so I just decided, like I've done maybe 30 times already on this retreat, at least, maybe more, I'm going to go for a walk. So I'm just going to go for a walk in the woods, like a perfectly normal thing to do, right? But I'm really sort of focused and quite concentrated. So I'm walking quite slowly. And at a certain point, I'm just sort of stopped. And it's not like I was unconscious, well, I think I'll just stand here for a while. It's just like I just stopped. And I just stood there looking at the colors and the form and seeing that the forest wasn't a bunch of separate things. It was just one thing. That's the only way I can describe it. It was like there's something here that's all just one thing. There's a vibratory energy to the whole thing. And I don't know how long I stood there. Not a long time, but maybe 3, 4 minutes, I suppose. And it was like nothing I'd ever experienced before was like that in terms of just taking in the world around me. And that's when I think that's a moment of one of these mini moments of enlightenment. Like this was like waking up to seeing that everything was just one thing, that there was no separation. That's what it felt like. And then, of course, it went away, and I went and had some dinner. I mean, that's the nature of these things. They arise, and then they're gone. But it was something distinctly purely different than my normal day-to-day go for a walk in the woods. And, oh, nice trees. Yeah. Oh, look, there's the squirrel. Which is also pleasant, but this was like distinctly and quite powerfully different. And it just was there. And then it was gone. I don't know, it arises there for a while and it's gone. This is just the nature of our practice, that we start to have more and more moments that are a bit longer, where we go, oh, that's what they've been talking about. I wish I could explain it better than that, but I can't. There is, in the history of Buddhism, early on, especially in the bhikkhunis, the nuns, there was this tradition where they would, when they became enlightened, and many nuns in the Buddhist day became enlightened. This is one thing the Buddha emphasized so strongly, is that women were perfectly capable of doing this practice, and it wasn't just for men. Which, of course, is something that really upset the Brahmins, because the Brahmins said, no, you're a woman, well, that's too bad, just wait, next lifetime, if you're lucky, you'll get a male body, and then you can, study the scriptures. And Buddha said, no, anybody can do this. And so this is one such enlightenment poem, which in some sense talks to what I've been talking about. So literally, they would reach enlightenment, be acknowledged as being enlightened by the Buddha, and then they would, this poem would sort of spontaneously arise somehow. I don't understand the process of that even. This is a woman named Patakara. When they plow their fields and sow seeds in the earth, when they care for their wives and children, young Brahmins find riches. So she's describing how the world was and the world she came from, right? But I've done everything right, and I follow the rule of my teacher. I'm not lazy or proud. Why haven't I found peace? So she's struggling with that question of, like, here I am, I've been really practicing diligently. How come I haven't reached enlightenment? What's going on here? Then, bathing my feet, I watched the bathwater spill down the slope. I concentrated my mind the way you train a good horse. Then I took a lamp and went into my cell, checked the bed, and sat down on it. I took a needle and pushed down the wick. When the lamp went out, my mind was freed. So that sort of sounds like instantaneous, but she said, I've been practicing for a long time and following all the teachers. So she's practiced and practiced and practiced and practiced, and then something as simple as washing her feet and watching the water run down the side of the hill. It's just total mundane everyday thing, but something about it set something in motion. She took a candle, looked at the candle, put the candle out. When the lamp went out, my mind was free. Don't ask me to explain this, but that's what, if you start looking at the Buddha's teaching and reading the suttas and reading books like this, which are collections of the poems of these bhikkhunis, they're all the same in that sense. Like, it's like I practiced for a long time, and then all of a sudden, pff, this happened. Totally, seemingly at random, but only after long practice. So, what am I saying here? We're all on the path. That's number one. We're all, everyone, you're not here because you're didn't have anything better to do tonight, and you just thought you'd go hang out with these people. So you're practicing and studying. You're on the path. You're moving towards enlightenment. That's the nature of these teachings and the nature of this practice. We're moving in a particular direction towards enlightenment. It's hard to see, it's difficult to understand, hard to grasp even. But that's what we're doing. And we're awakening little tiny bits. Little tiny bits. You know, Sharon Salzberg has this great image she uses. She says, we're planting seeds. Every time we sit and practice, we're planting the seeds of enlightenment. And at some point, those seeds are going to sprout. How do we make them sprout? Who knows? We just keep practicing. But one day, that's where we're headed. And it might be that we have, like, lucky me, through my years of practice, I've had these little moments where, like, oh, this is what it's about occur, that are distinct enough and last long enough that I can see the difference in the experience, the oneness of those experiences I've had. But that's just, I can't make any of them happen. I can't sort of on demand, oh, I think I'll have one of those experiences today, you know? It's just like you do the practice and then things happen. I wish I had a magic formula for you all, but I have no magic at all. I just practice. But here's one other thought. There's one more bit of sutta. This is from the Majjhima Nikaya. And the Buddha's talking about someone, how you can tell someone's enlightened. And he's talking about it in the context of the Brahma Viharas. And he, actually, this same passage is repeated four times for each of the four Brahma Viharas. I won't read it all. But here's what he has to say about, you know, what an enlightened being would experience or be like by in terms of metta. He abides pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness. Likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth, so above, below, around, and everywhere. And to all as to himself, he imbibes pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness. So he's saying that that metta, loving kindness, for an enlightened being is something they experience all the time, and it flows out in all directions. And then there's these beautiful words. With a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility, and without ill will. That's an interesting definition of enlightenment. But look at these words, abundant. Abundant means you always have enough. It never runs out. Exalted. So it's not only is it that you never run out, you always have enough, but it's exalted, it's uplifting, it's has some power to it that is quite palpable. And it's immeasurable. You can't say, oh well, I got 20,000 gazillion gallons of loving kindness now. That's it. It's immeasurable. There's no way you can say how much it is. There's no definition of it. It's immeasurable. In some traditions, the Brahma Viharas are called the four immeasurables, as a matter of fact, with this coming out of this scripture. And then without hostility and without ill will, that means there's no unwholesome mind states. We're not causing any trouble anywhere. We're full, we're imbued with loving kindness. not only for everything else, but also for ourselves. As to him, everywhere, all, and to all as to himself. And to all as to himself. So not only for everyone else, but for yourself as well. It doesn't change. It's everything, everywhere. Abundant, exalted, and immeasurable. I'll take some of that, please. Okay. And of course, there's also poetry. Poetry often explains these things. This is from Dana Fald's book, Going In In. It's called Awakening. Awakening, can I withstand the radiance? When the goddess gazes from my eyes, when my heart opens wide, when the current of life sweeps me far from safety, when even the illusion of control is lost, and what is left to me is love, can I breathe a prayer of gratitude and praise? Unlike the winter groundhog, can I raise my face to the sun and not run from the shadow? Then embodied, I will always cast in daylight. So I can be enlightened and still have a shadow self because I'm a human being. I think that's a really beautiful thought. You know, that being enlightened doesn't mean perfect in the sense of how we think we're supposed to be perfect. But this, I'm swept far from safety without even the illusion of control. We have to give up even the illusion that we have control. Not only just giving up control, we're giving up the illusion that we have control of this process, because we don't. It's just the practice, what happens. That's all we have.